Alright, so today I'll talk about the deception of the Young-Gans cluster at the Galactic Center as a resolution of the youth paradox. And this is not really part of the IGM program, I'm not an IGM person, but I also talk about our numerical technique, which I hope will be of some interest to the audience. And this is some work I've done with Mark Freitag of ARI Heidelberg and my advisor, Pedrazio at Northwestern. And this is, what happened? Oh, I hit the wrong key. So this is the outline of my talk. I'll first start by describing the problem, the observation of young stars near the galactic center, and I'll come to the Monte Carlo simulations of Young-Gans clusters, and in particular the formation of an intermediate mass black hole by runaway collisions. This is something we did recently. And then I relate this phenomenon to the spiral of the Young-Gans cluster to the galactic center, which is our proposed solution for this youth paradox. Now this is an infrared, I believe, K-band image of our galactic center. This image is almost a parsec across, and the central black hole is right there. As you see, this is a very rich image. There are many sources, and the stars that are resolved in this image are supposedly young helium 1 line emission stars. And their estimated age is about 3 to 7 mega years old. I put a question mark there because, well, this is something disputed. It's not very certain. And these stars that are observed at the galactic center have some interesting dynamical properties. One of them is that, in particular, these sources, the IGM16 cluster, seems to be all concentrated on two counter-rotating disks around the central black hole. And the other one is IGM13, which is now resolved into more sources itself. This is from a press release which made news recently, and I heard it in Germany through made the visit channel. That it's now resolved into the part of it, IGM13E, is now resolved into seven stars, which form a very compact dense cluster. It's gravitational bond and co-moving. If you look deeper to the galactic center, this is now about 0.05 parsecs across, we see more stars. Now they are not as young as the ones that are further out, but they are still relatively young, 10 megayears, and they are pretty bright. And some of them approach as close as 100 astronomical units to the galactic center black hole. It's of course very small. And again, they have this interesting dynamical property that if you look at their eccentricities, the average is a little higher than what you would expect from a normal distribution. Now, okay, so this is all very nice, and then what's the problem? The problem is that these stars are not supposed to be there at all, because the environment at the galactic center is too hostile. That to form a star there, the required Roche limit of your molecular cloud needs to be very high, and it's not my area of expertise, but I'm told that the required density is unrealistic. So if they're not born there, they must have went there somehow. And of course, they can go there by dynamical friction, but it takes too long. These stars are way too young to form somewhere and migrate there, and hence we have a paradox of youth. In addition, if you want to explain this paradox, you also need to explain the clear dynamical properties. I mean, if you can just explain the youth problem, it will be fine. That's a good thing in itself, but it will be a nice bonus if you can also explain dynamical properties. And there have been a couple of solutions that are suggested. One of them is the in-situ formation. As I said, the expected density, the required densities are unrealistic, but well, this is nature. We don't know how it exactly behaves, so it might be. And there is an alternative scenario to in-situ formation, or there's a variation of the scenario that you have two molecular clouds. They spiral in because they're massive enough, and then they collide near the massive black hole. And then this increases densities and triggers the star formation. Now this is a nice scenario. It might work, and it also explains these two counter-rotating disks around the central black hole. But no one has ever done such a simulation. We don't know what really happens. I mean, quantitatively this makes sense, but no one has ever took two molecular clouds, collided them, and formed these stars, and see what happened in the vicinity of a black hole. The other alternative scenario is that they are not young. There is something in the environment that makes them look young, but they're actually not young, or they're rejuvenated. So they underwent some process. Maybe they went too close to the black hole, they got squeezed, and got hotter and brighter, and they look younger, or they collided with each other. Now it turns out both of these scenarios are not enough. Their rates are wrong. If you calculate the number of stars that you can create this way, it's 0.1 to 1. And we see tens of these stars. So rejuvenation scenario doesn't really work. And the scenario that we try to investigate is the accelerated spiral via cluster. So again, it's a dynamical friction. You start from somewhere where the stress can actually form, but now dynamical friction can act efficiently enough in your star's lifetime because the cluster is much more massive. So the spiral rate will be much higher. And there's a twist to the scenario that you'll have an intermediate mass black hole in our cluster. And this is because even if you have a cluster, it will dissolve, it will disrupt at about 1 parsec from a galactic black hole. And then if you have an intermediate mass black hole in the cluster, this can further interact with these stars and scatter them into these eccentric orbits. And this is something we actually see in our solar system. Jupiter interacts with the asteroids and it puts them into inner, very eccentric orbits around the Sun. So this can quantitatively work, and this is what we try to investigate. Now I'll now talk about our method of investigation. And before I can talk about it, I need to talk about the clusters that we are studying. Now these are collisional and very dense star clusters. When I say collisional, it doesn't mean that stars actually collide with each other, but that they come close enough to each other that the orbits are perturbed, which is much different from the galactic simulations and the dark matter simulations. So as a result of this collisional situation, relaxation plays an important role. The orbits are sufficiently perturbed over the lifetime of the system and over the lifetime of the stars. But one thing about these systems are they're in quasi-equilibrium, and I'll elaborate on this in a moment. And the system in the study easily reach hundreds of thousands of stars. Now this is a small number for galactic dynamics, but for collisional dense star clusters, it's a very large number. So you can't actually solve the Newton's equation honestly. Even with special purpose computers, you have to stop at some point and a million is simply not reachable. So what you do is you make some approximation, and that approximation depends on some assumptions. One of them is spherical symmetry, and the other one is the quasi-equilibrium. So what I mean by spherical symmetry is that we represent the stars simply as spherical shells, so we have a simple number for their coordinate, their distance from the center of the cluster, and represent their velocity with two numbers, the radial and tangential component. And then there is a one-to-one correspondence between these numbers and the energy and angular momentum. And this allows us to calculate the potential very fast. Now, normally, in a star cluster, potential calculation is an n-square process. Right? And you roughly take your number of steps is roughly proportional to number of stars, so your whole simulation takes n cubed. In this case, it doesn't, because we'll cut on the number of steps, and then potential can be calculated as an n process, because potential of a spherical shell, everybody knows. It's constant within, and the outside looks like a point mass. And this allows us, this fast calculation of potential allows us to fast calculation of the orbits. And again, this is a result of spherical symmetry, because then you can approximate your orbit, and it's just to be filling an annulus. Okay. So this is the quasi-equilibrium, and I'll try to describe it as a using an analogy. So assume that you have a bucket, right? And you pour some water in it, and initially there will be some waves on the surface, and this is the violent relaxation phase, and your molecular cloud collapses and forms the stars. Maybe there's too much kinetic energy, maybe there's too little kinetic energy, so there's some initial violent relaxation. And then it comes to an equilibrium. Eventually it settles down. And now if you open a small hole at the bottom of the bucket, the surface will move, but there is still an equilibrium. So the idea, the analogy for a star cluster is that stars go about their orbits. There is a well-defined orbit, but the orbits are perturbed. So this is the kind of system that we can handle. If it's the violent relaxation, then our method cannot handle it. But it turns out it's not necessary because, the system is not in violent relaxation most of the time. And this is the flow chart of our technique. So we start with the potential density pair, and then we calculate our position and velocities from here. We solve the orbit equation and obtain the upper center and pericenter distances. And then we determine, we pick a new position of each of the stars in the cluster by a Monte Carlo process, hence our method is called the Monte Carlo simulation. We throw a die and we pick up a new position on the orbit by using a distribution function that's proportional to the time spent on that part of the orbit. So most of the time you spend around your upper center and very little time around your pericenter. So when you throw the die, it will be closer to your upper center. Now once you pick this new position, from there you can calculate your velocities, so because you know the orbit. You calculate the orbit already. And then you say, okay, I'll take a small time step. And over this time step, I know how much the star should be perturbed. Because this is relaxation. Relaxation is something you can calculate analytically if you know the velocity, dispersion, and density. So you perturb these orbits at that point, and then this gives you any distribution, and you just cycle over. And if you have additional physics, you can edit at that point. If you have collisions, if you have stellar evolution that changes the mass, you can edit at that point, just when you evolve, when you perturb the stuff.
So how do you perturb it? I mean, you're sending this thing on a trajectory towards the center? And
right, so it is an orbit. So at a given point, when I move to a new position, it has a new velocity. And then I can calculate from the density and the velocity dispersion how much its velocity should be perturbed for a given time. So I take this much time step, and in this much time step, this orbit gets perturbed this much. And I just switch it randomly.
You assume you know what the global motion of this bunch of stars is going to be towards the center? And then you work
no, out. The only thing I assume is that the relaxation is a dominant process, so I know the perturbation. I don't know the exact motion, but I know the velocity distribution. So what we are calculating is the rate. We are not, if there is some process that's happening on an orbital time scale, we can't resolve that. But this is just relaxation, so we know how the orbits change. So this is why actually I put the energy and angular momentum here, because although it's more intuitive to work with the position and velocities, what we do is energy and angular momentum, just a diffusion in that space. And actually, when this PDF gets posted on the web, there will be reference at the very end, so you can look it up. But I mean, this is amazing. It's the most fascinating thing about this method is that it actually works. And it does work. You can test this with normal n-body by decreasing the number of stars. There are, you know, two methods can work simultaneously, and it's just compatible with it. So we applied this method to very young dense star clusters with realistic initial mass function. And when I say realistic here, it's just the maximum mass to average mass ratio is about 100, which is realistic. If you start from 0.1 to 100 solar masses, then this roughly holds. And we found that the core collapse, in this case, will be very rapid. Now, the core collapse is, of course, when you start the cluster, the inner parts contract, and the density there increases, target close to each other. And this is usually done with stars, with systems where the masses of all stars are the same. And when you have a realistic mass function, it becomes faster by two orders of magnitude. And then you can make it, this core collapse time, faster than 3 mega years, which is about the lifetime of a massive star. And these massive stars will be restricted by core collapse to a very small region of space, and they'll start colliding with each other. And then eventually you form a very massive star, even at a moderate-sized cluster that's much larger than 100 solar masses. And then a magic happens, and we get an intermediate mass black hole. Now, we don't really know if we can form a black hole that way. But, you know, for the purpose of this talk, let's assume it actually happens, because we don't know if it won't happen either. So this is the cartoon of runaway growth. You start with some clusters. This is mass on the vertical axis, and horizontal axis is almost time, although it's not linear. So initially you start colliding your stars, you grow a black hole that's about 1,000 solar masses, and then it continues to collide with other stars, mostly with the massive ones, because these massive ones will migrate to the center of your cluster, and they are more likely to collide with this. And eventually, at some point, you stop. You reach this. Yeah?
With your mass function that makes the compass time move fast, how long does it take for the first star to go supernova?
3 mega years. Not for supernova, but for evolving off the mean sequence.
Okay.
So that will be maybe 3.3 mega years.
Okay.
So this continues colliding, mostly with massive stars, and eventually you reach some large star, and here your stars evolve off mean sequence, then you have to stop the collision. And we found that there's a simple relation between the mass of the cluster and mass of the collapse core. It's just about 0.2%. Right, so how does this relate to what we see at the center of our galaxy? Well, this cluster, while going under core collapse and forming the intermediate mass black hole and everything, it will go towards the galactic center by dynamic friction. I don't expect you to remember this. It's just to show you that it's a very simple formula. This is actually integrable. You know, for a power law mass distribution galaxy, you can integrate this exactly. And for the actual mass distribution, it's a little more complicated, but you can treat this analytically. You don't need to treat all of the galaxy as a distribution of mass and put your cluster there and let it, you know, move towards the center. Honestly, you can just say this will move at this rate. So as it moves towards the galactic center, I should have said a couple of things before, but okay, your cluster is tidally limited, which means it's, so if this is where your cluster is, this is radiographic centers, there is an equipotential surface around your cluster beyond which, if the stars go beyond this radius, then they will no longer be bound to your cluster. And as you're going towards the galactic center, this Jacobi radius, the radius of this Roche lobe, will shrink for two reasons. One, it's getting closer to the galactic center, and two, you'll be losing mass as you go down. And as a result, at some point, your cluster has to disrupt. It will become unbound. You can't go indefinitely. Well, you can, but because you have finite mass and finite distribution, that eventually the dynamical friction will get less and less effective, and you'll stop at radius, and at that radius, you'll just disintegrate. Right. But if you forget about this for a second and say, I'll keep all my mass, the point mass, and go towards the center without any disruption, then we can calculate things analytically. And we have two conditions. First, we want to reach the galactic center between 3 and 10 mega years, which is the lifetime of the stars that are observed there. And the second one is, I want to go under core collapse before I can inspire. And if you do this, you find a simple result. This is your initial distance from galactic center, and this is your initial mass. And these are the constraints. So this is for 3 mega years in spiral time, this is 10 mega years in spiral time, you have to be below this line. And these are for different King models. And to the right, it has higher concentration for the initial model. And you need to be to the left of these lines. This is the constraints for having core collapse before in spiral, and these are the constraints for in spiral being less than 3 or 10 mega years. So as you see, there is a wide region that's available here. W0 equals 9 King model is a plausible. It's not too highly concentrated. It's a plausible model. It can happen.
This is where they're born? That's where you have to be born?
You have to be in this region. But if you are above this line, it means it will take longer than 10 mega years
to
get to the galactic center.
Okay.
Then you can't explain the stars yet. Yes.
But isn't it more restricted than that? Because for the lower mass end at the 10 mega years, you already have a bunch of things blowing apart.
Right. So it is. This is point mass approximation. But this is, before you make the simulation, you want to know where to start. So this is just the simplest thing. And the point here is there is some space that's available. It's not. If, for instance, I got zero area here, then I wouldn't make any simulation. I said this won't work at all. Good. And then the next certain approximation is that you have a set cluster. You have the density, but you don't evolve it. And when you do this, now this is what I'm putting here is the distance from the galactic center in parsecs and time in mega years. This is a point mass. And this is the W0 equals 19 model. As you see, disruption happens at a finite distance. Because as it goes in, it starts losing mass, and dynamical friction gets less efficient, and then it deviates from the point mass, and eventually it disrupts at this distance. Which is very encouraging, because this is point one. This is where you see the stars. It's perfect. But this is still an approximation. It's not good because, let me show you the real thing. Because the cluster evolves. And the evolution of cluster actually expands it. That makes the mass loss more efficient. So here is your point mass in short dashed line. And then W0 equals 9 without any evolution. This one. And this is the real thing when you make a simulation. It's even worse than that. But still, you can reach within one parsec. Now, it turns out that approximations provide the necessary conditions, but they're not sufficient. And it is very consistent. If something doesn't work for this approximation, extended cluster, it won't work for the simulation either. And then one criticism that was against this scenario was that if you start with a very massive cluster, and if you let it in spiral, it will leave some stars behind. Okay, it will provide young stars at the galactic center, but what about the stars left behind? And we don't see young stars outside 2 parsecs. Right? And these approximations don't provide the star demographics outside 2 parsecs, but real simulation will do. And we'll see that it actually partially answers that criticism. Okay, so these are our results. Again, you can forget about this. It's just, if you look, that there is, you can go for certain conditions, reach the disruption less than 3 or 10 mega years, and you can reach the 1 or 2 parsecs. That's just the point. And we also find that it's not possible to reach 0.1 parsec under extreme conditions. You can't do it. You have to start with very high concentration, very large mass. You might as well just bring the molecular cloud there, then you don't need to have this form a cluster outside your central parsec. And you find that moderately high concentrations are necessary. This is, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this. This is the King model dimensionless central potential. But usually global clusters fit to 3 to 5. And then if it's core collapsed, then it looks like a 6 to 9 W0 parameter. And then we also found that you need about 1 million solar masses for this to be efficient. So you can reach the central parsec in 3 mega years. And this is the results from one of our simulations. This is not the typical result, of course, it's one of the better results. We start with 2 million solar masses at 10 parsecs, and the cluster disrupted in 0.5 mega year, and disrupted a distance of 0.6 parsec from the galactic center. And at that time, the collapse core was 5,000 solar masses, which we think will form an intermediate mass black hole. Of course, that's the mass available to the massive black hole, probably only a small fraction of it will go there. So what about the stars left behind? This is the surface density of the stars that left the cluster, and this is the background surface density of the galaxy. So as you see, we can't tell that the cluster has been there just from the surface density. But you can look at the stars, the young bright stars, because they are more readily seeable. And even then, you see that most of the heavy stars, this is, I forget about this for a second, this is the distance from the galactic center in decreasing, and this is the number of stars for each mass spin. And here I'm plotting the number of stars that are more massive than 60 solar mass initially. And most of them, this is the same model that I showed that disrupted 0.6 parsec, most of them is within a couple parsec of the galactic center. And very few are, this is logarithmic, so very few are actually left behind.
How long did it take to get those in? Sorry,
Adam. 0.5 mega year. Okay. I think, let me check. Right, 0.5 mega year. And then this is the same information, it's a little more detailed, but let's forget about it, because I think I'm running out of time. Right. And finally, this is the retained cusp. Those were the stars left behind. This is what's actually in the cusp, and the cluster goes core collapse. And as you see, the mass function is much flattened. Now, this is our initial mass function, Salpeter, and all the heavy stars are retained in the cluster, so it's a much flatter mass function. And the density of the cluster always stays higher than the background. That's a, otherwise it wouldn't actually spiral in. So it has to be higher than the background. And the velocity dispersion always stays lower than the background, which means it has to, when it disrupts, there will be some clumping. It will look like some collection of stars. It won't be gravitationally bound, it's disrupted, but it will still be co-moving because its velocity dispersion is much lower than the background. And just the numbers, this model was 80 kilometers per second. Velocity dispersion, which is very low with respect to what you see at the central parsec. It won't be torn apart. Right. And here are my conclusions. We've shown that it's possible to bring a star cluster from 10 to 1 parsec within 3 mega years. I've shown only one result, but there is more. That one I showed to 0.5 mega year, but sometimes you reach this 3 mega years. And this requires to start with a cluster that's more than 1 million solar masses, roughly, and moderate high concentration. The heaviest stars are deposited close to the center of the galaxy. So this answers the main criticism against the scenario. But this scenario doesn't actually predict young stars outside a couple of parsecs. I'm not sure whether this is compatible with the observations, but it's at least we don't leave everything at 10 parsec. And we also find that the clusters that are concentrated enough not to be disrupted will go under core collapse and then form an intermediate mass black hole. There is some future work that we plan to do, but we not necessarily including me. But the evolution of the retained cusp, that intermediate mass black hole and the cusp of stars around it, and the dynamics of the intermediate mass black hole after a disruption, and the inner parsec, the inner 0.1 parsec stars still need to be analyzed quantitatively. That's it.
Once in the lifetime of the Milky Way, this kind of a...
No, this is supposed to be a continuous process. I mean, the molecular clouds are always there, and they can always collide, form a cluster, and that will spiral in all the time.
So maybe you see this. Are there like a lot of supernova remnants? Or can you see anything? You think
supernova remnants will go off in 10,000 years or so. You can't see them anymore.
How many intermediate mass black holes do you predict given for just the regular lifetime of these clusters getting into this, the densum of clusters?
Okay, the formation of the intermediate mass black hole depends on your initial conditions. The core collapse time requires to be less than 3 mega years. That's the line. So I don't know. If you can tell me the parameters of the cluster that will form, then I can calculate their core collapse time and tell you how many of them will form during that cycle. But we don't know the demographics of the star clusters that well, so I can't tell.
So the distribution of W now is unknown.
No, not for these clusters. For global clusters, of course, but for young star clusters, it's even not possible to make a W not fit.
If your cluster is spiraling in by dynamic perfection, it will transfer orbital energy to the background. So the background will respond to the sinking of the cluster.
Right. Yes.
When you take into account self-consistently the fact that the dense distribution of the background will change as the cluster is spiraling in.
But that's very small. The density is significant, but when you project it over the sky, you can't see it. And I don't do the honest simulation by treating the galaxy as a distribution of mass and putting a mass there as a spiral, but Norris and Kim did this. And our results, the dynamic perfection formula that I use, is fully compatible with what they find. So I think it works, but whether you can see the effect observationally, I think that's impossible, because the perturbation, even though density is significant, the surface density is not.
What's your implied star formation rate in these clusters?
What do you mean?
What's the star formation rate you need to reproduce observations? Because you make a lot of these clusters.
You would need a cluster like this to form every 3 mega years, 10 mega years. Now, whatever the lifetime of the stars is, because unless you are very lucky to see these stars there, it must be continuous. So if you produce one of these every 3 mega years, then it will continuously feed this, and you'll always have this. And there's other evidence. Now, if you look at the Arches cluster and just the population itself, there is evidence that there was some starburst within 10 parsec. Now, well, Arches is beyond that, but if you look at young stars, that in the central region of the galaxy, there was starburst, 7, 10 mega years ago. So maybe we are lucky. Maybe this doesn't happen continuously.
Yeah,